I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. On January 6, 2021, I was home prepping for the next day's interview, watching in shock and horror as a violent mob of Trump supporters attacked the Capitol in an attempt to stop the certification of the results of the 2020 presidential election.
Millions of Americans are out
to protect the Constitution of the United States against enemies, foreign and domestic!
There was a gallows constructed outside with calls to hang Vice President Mike Pence. The crowd engaged in hand-to-hand combat with Capitol Police, broke into the building and roamed the halls looking for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress who hid, terrified for their lives. I should add that sound is from New Yorker reporter Luke Mogelson. Meanwhile, President Trump, who had told the crowd earlier that day he would go with them to the Capitol, was at the White House watching and reportedly enjoying the mayhem on TV, while some members of his administration and some Fox News hosts begged him to call off the crowd, which he finally did at the end of the day, telling them, "Go home. We love you. You're very special." Today on Radio Times, how should we remember the January 6th insurrection? And are there lessons from the past that can give us some direction, even some hope? And joining us is Kevin Cruz. He's a professor of history, director of the Center for Collaborative History at Princeton University, where he studies political, social, and urban suburban history of the 20th century. He's the author of a number of books, including most recently Fault Lines, A History of America Since 1974, which he wrote with Julian Zelizer. In fact, was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book. Kevin Cruz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
So great to be here, Marty.
And to our listeners, I want to make sure that you can join our conversation. It's really important that we all talk together about the future of our democracy. And you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Kevin, I was talking about what I was doing that day. I think a lot of people were watching their TV on January 6, 2021. What were you doing?
I was doing the same thing. I mean, I'd written a piece about Trump holding the rally at the Ellipse, which something past presidents had done as a way to kind of rally their supporters. And I kind of thought it was going to fit in that frame, and it quickly went off the rails. And it was just kind of devastating to watch it unfold in real time.
How should we mark that day? I mean, it's tomorrow. That's the first anniversary. A moment of silence. I mean, how should we remember January 6, 2021?
I would say silence is the last thing we need at this moment.
Okay, fair enough.
It's a lot of talking and a lot of listening. And it shouldn't just be on the anniversary. It really should have been every single day since then. The fact that we're a year out, and I suppose we're going to hear from Merrick Garland later today about the inaction of the Department of Justice. But we're a year out, and there's still very little accountability for those at the top. A lot of the rank and file have been arrested, but the people who organized, encouraged, and egged on this thing that even Mitch McConnell called an insurrection have not really been held accountable.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because the initial shock of that day that seemed to have set even people like Mitch McConnell off has faded off. And Republicans have largely kind of returned to their partisan corner and are in a state of denial about this, have kind of spewn an alternative version of the facts, as Kellyanne Conway might have said, and are wedded to that. They've really tried to sweep this under the rug, have created an alternate reality in which this is all some kind of Antifa plot or something crazy like that. And that's the story they're going to run with now.
I've heard on the other hand or on the other side that Biden was sworn in as president of the United States. The House did vote to certify the results of the election. The courts ruled against Trump and his allies multiple times as a sign that the system held, that yes, there were threats, but that, you know, a duly elected president became president and the system held. What do you say to that?
Well, I think I'd say yes, the system held, but the system held because of the actions of individual people, right? And I, as an historian, I don't like to place too much weight on the actions of any one individual at any one time. But in this case, I think it really didn't matter. And so if you look at the fact that Mike Pence did not go along with the scheme, to his credit, and a number of Republican secretaries of state in charge of certifying the results in their state elections did not go along with the pressure brought by President Trump. Remember, it was a little more than a year ago that he was calling Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State in Georgia, saying, "I need you to find, you know, 11,000 something more votes in order to get me to win." And we got lucky there that we had people in those positions of power at those kind of pivotal stress points who were up to the task. The problem right now is that those positions are up for election this year in many states in 2022. And there are a number of Secretary of State candidates endorsed by Donald Trump who have vowed openly to do the opposite, to call for endless audits of election returns, to give state legislatures, which are incredibly partisan, an incredible amount of power, even to override election officials. So there is a sense that we dodged a bullet this last time. That doesn't mean we're bulletproof, right?
Well, let me ask you, as a historian, and I was, you know, checking my memory bank, I'm old enough certainly to remember the assassinations of the 1960s, of Watergate, of Iran-Contra, of Clinton's impeachment, of September 11th. I'm thinking of all the, frankly, the crises and attacks that this country has had. Are we in a uniquely different place today?
Yeah, I think we are. Because those ones you named before, I guess, kind of fell into two different categories, right? There were ones that were seen as attacks on the nation.
Right.
And whether that was the assassination of a president or a terrorist attacks on 9/11 in New York and Washington, D.C., those were seen as attacks on all of us. Or these crises, such as, say, the Clinton impeachment or Nixon's impeachment, were seen as the actions of a few, you know, rotten individuals, right? What we have here is something that's in between. And it's not something that is an attack on all of us or something that only implicates a few of us. It's rather a problem in which, due to the actions of the Republican Party over the last year, they have largely rallied around Trump and the theory that he has about January 6th, that the election was somehow stolen, that he was somehow right to object to it, that any scheme to overthrow the election, to have a coup in effect, was warranted. And the party has largely coalesced around that. And that's what makes this different. It's just not an attack on the whole nation. It's not a scandal that implicates a few people. It's something in which about half the nation, or at least half of the nation's political organizations, have decided is something entirely different.
Well, speaking of former President Trump, he used birtherism as a way to, I guess, get attention, but also to criticize our first black president. Do you see a connection between the birther lie and his continuing to lie about the results of the 2020 election?
Yeah, well, from Trump's angle, I mean, it certainly shows a consistency and a certain willingness to disregard the facts, to say whatever is necessary to keep him afloat in any one moment, to get his name in the papers, to keep him in power. In a larger sense, though, I think the two are connected in that both fundamentally speak to a sense on the part of large segments of Trump supporters that they're losing the nation, right? The election of the first black president was seen by many as a sign of, you know, the accomplishments of America, that this country with the original sin of slavery, as we often say, had managed to elect an African-American president, a sign of how far we'd come. For some, though, it was seen as a sign of how much they had lost, and a sense that the country they thought they knew, the country they thought they claimed as their own, as looking like them, had slipped away. And that's something I think Trump tapped into throughout his presidency, that sense of they were losing their country, that they needed to, you know, make America great again, to restore it to an earlier time, that he was in charge of that movement. And that rallied a lot of people around him.
So when you look at the photographs or even looked at the video of the January 6th insurrection, do you then see white rage? Is that what you see on display?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the audio clip you played at the start here, I think, really captured it. There's a man there screaming, that they had a duty to protect the country from all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Right.
That was being uttered by somebody who was part of a mob storming the Capitol of the United States, Congress, doing combat with U.S. Capitol Police, part of a mob that was, at least for some of them, looking for members of Congress to commit acts of violence against in pursuit of a scheme to overthrow a duly constituted election. And yet he was saying that they are the ones defending the country from its enemies, foreign and domestic. They didn't see themselves as domestic enemies. They saw Biden, they saw Democrats, they saw whoever else as enemies. Again, it's the sense of victimhood, of righteous victimhood, that they are the oppressed and that they have a duty and obligation, not just to themselves, but to the country, to stand up and commit violence, even if that's necessary.
Well, and I've tried to put myself in their shoes, saying if I truly, truly, truly believed that an election was stolen and that what, I mean, you know, you have to believe a lot of conspiracy theories. So I, you know, I don't end up where they do, but I'm trying to put myself in their mindset that they believed that they could attack the Capitol because they believed that the election was fraudulent and was stolen from them and their leader, Donald Trump.
And that's an act that historians do all the time. We have to empathize with the people we're analyzing. We don't have to sympathize with them, but try to understand where they're coming from. So that's a vital act here. It doesn't mean we're excusing them, but we need to try to understand them. And I do think that's it, is that it comes from a place in which they do see themselves, I think wrongly, but they see themselves as the victims of a larger process. And they see themselves in all their manifestations as a representation of the majority will, right? Which is remarkable given that Trump in both elections didn't win a majority of votes, that he never once, I think, in the entire history of his presidency had majority approval ratings. He never had, you know, the full backing of the, or even a majority of the country that he led for 4 years. And yet they see themselves as representative of the real America, of the true America, of a majority America, and seeing all these sinister forces aligned against them.
Something, and we're almost going to break you, but so something appealing about victimhood?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a way to, first of all, for politicians, victimhood is a great way to motivate voters. This has been a mainstay, especially on the right, since the Nixon era. Nixon's advisor, Kevin Phillips, said the whole secret to politics is knowing who hates who. And if you feed into those hatreds, you can win elections. Well, victims hate a lot of people. And they have a lot of people to blame. And if you can speak to that anger and stoke that sense of victimhood, you can get them to do virtually anything.
That is Kevin Cruz, our guest today on Radio Times. As we mark the coming up tomorrow, first anniversary of the terrorist insurgency attack on the U.S. Capitol and on our system of elections, he's a professor of history at at Princeton University. And we do want to hear from you. We've got comments and calls coming in. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. This week marks the first anniversary of the attack on the U.S. Capitol to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. We're talking with our guest, Kevin Cruz, a professor of history, director of the Center for Collaborative History at Princeton University, about the health and future of our democracy, whether our country can recover from the fallout from that day. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Kevin, there's almost a cliche to ask this question, but I feel the need to do that. If it had been a mob of black people on January 6, 2021, you know, attacking the Capitol, doing exactly what that largely white mob was doing, what would our reaction be? What would our conversation be?
I think it would have been radically different. I mean, you only have to look at the the reaction to protest over the last year, the difference between, say, a protest of Black Lives Matter activists and protests from, you know, armed mobs on the right. And the armed mobs on the right, largely of white people, have been treated with kid gloves. And Black Lives Matter protests have largely been handled incredibly harshly. I think that would have been the case here. You know, when open carry in California was never an issue until the Black Panthers showed up in Sacramento at the state capitol, carrying guns in keeping with the law at the time. And the law changed really quickly once that sight of black men with guns was seen. I think had we seen a black mob attacking the Capitol, I think it absolutely would have led to a wildly different a set of outcomes.
Well, and other historians have also talked about there's a kind of pattern when there's black advancement, then you've got white, you know, pushback, whether it was the black codes after the Civil War, even Donald Trump after Barack Obama. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. I mean, every racial advance, every advance on civil rights in this country since the Civil War, if not before, has always been met by a wave of white resentment and retrenchment. And that is, I think, certainly the case that we saw after the Civil Rights era. It's certainly the case we saw after the Obama presidency. I think Trump was kind of perfectly suited to tap into that grievance, to echo it and amplify it.
Let me read some comments. An email from Chris said, hate to bring up such a dark potential future, but if this country tragically descends into a civil war in the next few years, would it be safe to say in the end it will be a fight for truth? And it, you know, we wanted to do this show, Kevin, but, you know, we don't want to alarm people. But do you feel like we are really at a serious crossroads and that civil war is a possibility?
I don't know about civil war. I mean, I think we're in an age where the U.S. military has this much capacity. I'm not sure anyone's going to rise up against it. I do think we are at a serious breaking point for democracy. And the urgency with which Congress needs to install protections for voting rights, to install protections so that another January 6th doesn't happen again, and to get to the truth of January 6th, and again, make sure that those responsible for it are held accountable, is really pressing.
Well, the panel has apparently interviewed several hundred people so far. We're getting little bits and pieces of some of that testimony. What do you hope the panel can accomplish? This is the House panel.
Well, I think, first of all, it needs to, you know, show its work. And it seems like it's been doing very productive stuff behind the scenes. And I understand that serves a purpose to kind of keep a low profile. They've kept a tight lid on their investigation in a lot of ways. But they've got to come forward and get into the public with this. There's talk, I think, that they're going to have maybe some prime time hearings. I think that's an excellent idea. That was vital in kind of informing the country about what was going on in Watergate and making sure the citizenry was kind of properly alarmed and ready to act and to demand action. So I think they need to do that, especially because there's this counter narrative that is really floating around on the right from a lot of Republican politicians, but also you know, the kind of the world of Fox News and the associated conservative media that is spreading an entirely different narrative about this, one in which the protesters on January 6th were involved in a noble cause, and they are martyrs, the ones who died. And that is something that I think is really alarming, to have that kind of counterfactual come back. And I think what we need to do is to return our attention to January 6th and the days after, in which, again, even prominent Republican officials like Mitch McConnell stated quite clearly what had happened and what had gone on. They've retreated from that view. But we need the hearings to be public and widely watched in order to get that real narrative out there and to get that false counter narrative gone.
Well, and there's a fight over a voting rights legislation in the Senate, which involves, you know, you guessed it, the filibuster. How can Democratic leaders figure out how to push that bill through?
Well, the need to push it through is clear. And if you look at the history of the filibuster, it has overwhelmingly been used to block civil rights in general and voting rights as well. And so to see it as an obstacle here again is not surprising. I think there's a will on the part of Democratic leadership, apparently, to try to get the rules changed. Of course, it's going to hinge on kind of the two recalcitrant Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who for some reason have been dragging their feet on this issue. And I think pressure needs to be applied to them, political pressure, as much as possible by the president and the leaders in the Senate to try to get this through, because it really does. It really is the vital issue. Everything really does depend on getting safe and secure elections in place. And there's a lot of talk on the right about that there are measures of voter suppression are needed because there's this widespread voter fraud that apparently is out there, but no one can find except for a handful of Trump supporters who've been found guilty of it. But what we really need from Congress is some secure protections for voting rights. And that depends on the filibuster being pushed aside for this measure, just as it has been. There's been exceptions for other things like the budget, and they need to secure this vital part of American democracy if we're going to continue.
Here's a comment from Patty. I don't see what more I can do as a citizen about this, and I don't see those who can do more actually doing more. For instance, she says, the Democratic Party seems to be stricken, mute, and paralyzed.
It is frustrating. And I think we have to remember that sense of frustration, that sense of helplessness is something that the people pushing this are hoping for. They hope the rest of us check out and don't pay attention. So there are some things we can do, especially those of you in Pennsylvania. There are vital elections coming up in 2022 but wherever you're listening, there are local and state elections to get involved in. Again, I can't stress how important the Secretary of State races are across the country, races for governor as well as obviously state legislatures too. These are all, some of these are positions we don't often think about. We don't think about Secretary of State races as being vitally important, or state legislature races maybe as being the most pressing issue before us on a ballot sometimes, but they really are, especially this year where those races are in 2022 are going to in a lot of ways determine how 2024 goes down. So I would, keep complaining to your elected officials and start working for people who you think are going to defend our elections.
See, I think Republicans and conservatives focused on those local elections, seeing how key they were to our political process.
Oh, they have been for years. And this is where Democrats and many liberals and leftists have really, I think, lost sight of what's really important. The right has been engaged in this for some time. You look at what groups like ALEC have done, or what different kind of conservative billionaires have done in terms of putting their money into state legislative races across the board. They understand how important these are. And I think there is hopefully a new awareness on the part of Democrats that they really need to get involved and get engaged. And I'm not just talking Democratic officials, but Democratic voters. But they really need to take these races incredibly seriously because they are vitally important.
And that is Kevin Cruz. He's a professor of history, director of the Center for Collaborative History at Princeton University. He studies political, social, and urban suburban history of the 20th century. And we are talking with him today on Radio Times about what happened on January 6, 2021, which, of course, the anniversary is tomorrow, the fate and future of our democracy, and what we can do to address the divisions within our country as well. Let me read a comment from PJ, who said, someone told me they knew as a fact that 100,000 people were witnessed crossing the Benjamin Franklin Bridge from Camden to stuff ballot boxes for Joe Biden in Philadelphia. PJ asks, how do you counter the lack of critical thinking that has been harnessed here? There aren't even that many people in Camden, especially that many people who would keep this secret. I think it's a really critical question because there are just so many outlandish beliefs about our electoral system and what allegedly happened in 2020.
That's a ludicrous one. I think what you would do is just to consistently press them to demand proof, and not to let up until they do or they admit they have no basis for saying that. I mean, 100,000 people crossing a bridge would seem to be something that would have been captured on a cell phone or a camera, or someone would have talked about. Someone might have noticed that. So press them on that, and if they persist in it. I mean, you know, you may not be able to persuade them, but you can at least make them recognize how ludicrous their claim might sound to other people.
I was asking about whether, you know, what white anger looked like, but I wonder about the sort of racial component as well, because we know that in, you know, in large cities like Philadelphia, there was no question they were going to go for Joe Biden. You know, it's a multicultural city, as are most cities. How do you see the component of race?
Well, I think it's vitally important. I mean, look, when Trump complained that there was fraud in Pennsylvania, he kept talking about Philadelphia.
Right.
Which actually had been a better place for him than some of the white collar suburbs around Philadelphia. Right. And so he didn't point the finger on places where Biden did a lot better, you know, like the suburbs. He instead pointed to the urban centers in, say, Philadelphia or Detroit or Atlanta. These are all the places he named, because I think in the eyes of many voters, especially his voters, urban means black. And that was a reason to be suspicious.
Here's a comment from Stu. The events of January 6th were the result of the process started by Ronald Reagan, who told us that our government was our enemy. The process continues. Kevin, is Stu onto something there?
I think so. I mean, this definitely moves back to the Reagan era. And it's not just Reagan and that attitude about government. It's the attitude that Republican activists had at the time about voting, right? They're quite open about this. There's a famous a rally in 1980 where Reagan wins the support of the religious right. But what's often overlooked there is there was another speech by Paul Weyrich, who's an organizer of the religious right, who said quite clearly, I don't want everyone to be able to vote. I don't believe he mocks what he calls the goo-goo voters, people who believe in good government. He says there's no such thing as good government. We need less government. And I want people like me to make the decisions. And the more we restrict the vote, the more we're going to be able to get what we want. And so those two things go hand in hand, this idea that government can't be trusted, but also that voters can't be trusted. They really go hand in hand. And I think they're both pernicious ideas, but ones that have spread deeply in certain corners of the country over the last 40, 50 years.
There's an Atlantic article a lot of people are talking about. The headline, Trump's next coup has already begun. January 6th was practice. You were quoted in there, Kevin Cruz. I forget his first name. I'm embarrassed.
Martin Gelman. Yeah.
Martin Gelman. Do you agree with that headline?
Yeah, I do. I think the people who, you know, kind of have this attitude of, well, there's nothing to worry about, January 6th failed, that doesn't mean it's going to fail again. I think what we've seen with a lot of Trumpism is that in a lot of ways we were saved both by the fact that his sway over the party wasn't complete, but also the fact that he and some of his cronies were kind of inept at a lot of this. I think in more skilled hands, whether it's Trump getting a do-over or someone following the model, I think this could absolutely happen again. There were too many moments of contingency here, which I think, again, with different people in different positions of power, could easily break a different way. And I don't think we quite realize what's going on right now. And the coverage of this is, I think, kind of responsible. We've kind of taken for granted that the Republicans are opposed to voting reforms, or that they're all rallying around Trump, and the focus is all on kind of why can't the Democrats do more to stop this? That's vitally important, of course. But I don't think we need to normalize the Republican kind of aversion to democracy at this point.
A question from Philip, sort of related to some of the things we've been talking about. How can we possibly pacify people and groups who are so angry? I mean, I think there are a lot of angry and very frustrated people in this country right now.
Yeah, it's tough. And again, you know, we've had anger in America over and over again. The question is where does that anger get channeled? How does that anger get directed? And the danger at this moment is that you've got a kind of perpetual grievance stoking machine in conservative media, which is linked up with the Trump movement in politics. And that's become really dangerous. And so yeah, I think it's ultimately, you know, I don't know if we're going to solve the anger right away. There's always going to be an audience for anger. But I think we can maybe address the ways in which that anger gets translated into political action. And that can be done by holding accountable the people who let their anger lead them to violence, but also holding accountable the people who have been stoking that anger.
Here's an email from Peter who says, is there evidence that Black Lives Matter and other protests, for instance, in Portland, Oregon, especially those that devolved into property destruction and violence, contributed to the GOP right-wing perception that predominantly Democratic urban areas are not to be trusted to conduct fairly conduct an election? The question being, you know, looking at the protests in some of these urban areas, whether that was a kind of a seed for what we've been talking about.
Oh, I'm sure it was. The problem there is that there's a conflation of violence on the part of a small segment of the protesters with the inability of public officials to hold a clean and fair election. I mean, those aren't really related. There's also the problem that some of that violence we now know was instigated by outsiders simply looking to stir up trouble. I think there was a case of someone with the Proud Boys who came up from Texas and firebombed that police station in Minneapolis, I believe was in the news a couple of days ago. So there's a lot going on there. I'm sure that contributed to the sense of outrage and victimhood on the right, but I think it's much more complex than they were led to believe.
We're almost out of time here. Kevin Cruz, is our democracy going to survive?
Well, I'm an historian. My training's in hindsight, so it's tough for me to predict. I will say that, you know, our democracy doesn't survive on its own, right? Democracy is not a spectator sport. It involves all of us, and we need to be reminded of that and act accordingly.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Marty.
And that's Kevin Cruz, professor of history, director of the Center for Collaborative History at Princeton University. And again, he studies political, social, and urban suburban history of 20th century America. He's written a number of books, and including one written just a couple of years ago with Julian Zelizer titled Fault Lines, A History of America Since 1974. Waiting in the wings, and she'll be joining us in just a moment or two, Pennsylvania Representative Madeleine Dean, who was there at the Capitol when the insurrection happened. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, tomorrow marks the first anniversary of the attack on the U.S. Capitol and our electoral process. As we all remember, a violent, raging mob of Trump supporters broke into the building, attacked police officers, called for the hanging of then-Vice President Mike Pence, terrorized members of Congress and their staff, and attempted to prevent the certification of the election of now-President Joe Biden. While the attempted coup fail, it left our democracy in tatters. Most Republicans don't believe Biden is the legitimate president, and former President Trump continues to lie about losing and election fraud. Joining us is Representative Madeleine Dean. She's a Democrat representing Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District. She was one of the managers for Trump's second impeachment. And Representative Dean, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's good to be with you.
And it's good to be with you as well. And again, I want to make sure our listeners can join us. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499. How are you, Madeleine Dean, going to remember what happened a year ago tomorrow?
Well, thank you for asking me. I decided I definitely wanted to be in Washington to observe the one-year anniversary of that horrific day. So I've just arrived in D.C., and I'll be participating in events tomorrow. My goal is to make sure that we forever remember January the 6th of last year, that we reflect on what it taught us and what it warned us of, and that we recommit ourselves to our precious democracy.
How are you doing? How is your staff doing? How are the Capitol Police, who are still on the job, how are they doing?
I'll start with the Capitol Police. I cannot say enough about the Capitol Police. Obviously, the video reveals and records the heroic actions that they took that day, protecting every one of us. A joint session of Congress with the Vice President presiding, the tremendous number of dedicated staffers. So I can't say enough about the Capitol Police, what they sacrificed, how they are still harmed, traumatized, injured, some deceased. As a result of being an impeachment manager, I wound up with a detail of Capitol Police. And so I got to know them even better and their selfless dedication. So I worry about them. I hope we pour the resources in that they need. Thank you for asking about my staff.
Sure.
My staff has been courageous, rattled like everyone else, often more worried about me than themselves. But we're all trying to cope with it and do as well as we can. And I remain shaken by the events of that day, stunned that this web and series of lies overtook the Capitol. And then sadly, what remains in my fear is that the lies that stormed the Capitol still remain a threat to our democracy.
Are you worried that the public either has lost interest or lost track of the horror of that day, or it's been downplayed or somehow justified? We hear that a third of Americans, according to some polls, believe that violence against the government is sometimes justified.
Those numbers and findings are shocking and they're stunning. I will say, just in speaking to my constituents, and I'll say Republicans and Democrats, they worry for me and our safety here at the Capitol as we do our work. So I don't think my constituents really reflect that. Certainly there are those who believe President Biden isn't our president. And what that really reveals is that the former president came to power fueled by misinformation, disinformation, and then downright lies. The people who stormed the Capitol, many of them believed the big lie. Many of them believe the big lie to this day. That's what is the grand takeaway. Our democracy depends upon truth and transparency and people swearing an oath and then abiding by that oath to the Constitution, not to a single failed president. I'm very worried for our democracy, and I hope that through the work of the 1-6 committee, which is meticulous and will in a very detailed way lay out for the American public exactly what happened and who was involved, who supported it, what money supported it, what did the former president do, what did he know, when did he know it, and what did he fail to do?
Let me ask you about your relationship with your Republican colleagues, and I'm just pulling out one name here. Kevin McCarthy is a GOP leader in the House. He called for censuring Trump. This was, I think, on January 13th, quoting, "The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters." Within a few days or even a week or so, he's down in Mar-a-Lago praising Trump, praising, you know, his endorsement and his popularity. Help us understand how you can have a relationship with your colleagues who maybe say one thing privately, but something else publicly.
And of course, Mr. McCarthy said that publicly in the hours following the insurrection, mm-hmm. and then did a complete backflip publicly. What I say is it's very hard to have a relationship with someone who has thrown away his own credibility. Marty, that's the only thing we bring with us. We bring with us our credibility, our words, and our words matter. And when you toss that away, as Mr. McCarthy and many others have, it is very difficult to trust them and to work with them. I've had one-on-one experience with Mr. McCarthy. It is not a healthy experience.
Really?
He is more a bully for whatever position he seems to be crouched in than somebody who is trying to build consensus and move legislation forward.
What about Liz Cheney? Do you worry for her?
I do. I'm mighty proud of her. When we were in that holding room, when we were taken out in gas masks and whisked to safety, eventually to a large holding room, Hundreds of us, including staff and even the press, waited for hours. I had the chance to speak to her very, very briefly. And I told her I was proud of her. She and Hakeem Jeffries, both then chairs of our caucuses, stood at parallel microphones in that room when we knew nothing and said, we will go back to the floor. They will not take us away from our constitutional responsibilities. So I went up to her and said, I'm just proud of you. We have to be single-minded. We can't be derailed by an attempted insurrection incited by a failed president. And I did say to her the expression that so many people have said, and I think the news about Mr. Hannity is reflecting the exact same thing. I said to her, don't they know they've gone too far? And so I'm proud of her. I'm worried for her. Look what happened to her, ostracized by her conference for speaking the truth. That's a party that has devolved into a cult. I'm just extremely, exceedingly proud of her for standing up for the truth, democracy, and the rule of law.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Representative Madeleine Dean. She's a Democrat. She does represent Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District, and she was in the Capitol, as were other members of Congress, on January 6, 2021, to certify the election of Joe Biden. And, of course, took place, but not until after a violent mob of Trump supporters attacked the building and terrorized the people inside. Let me quote something that you wrote in the Inquirer, on Philadelphia Inquirer, on Sunday. You believe that the attack on the Capitol, quote, would expose the dangers of anti-democratic lies of a, quote, stolen election, as well as the precious fragility of our republic. And you go on to say you were wrong. Why? Why has that not happened?
I don't know for sure, except the fuel and the power of lies over years worth of lies. This was, to me, felt like a 9/11 moment that we will come together as a nation. Of course, the distinction, 9/11, we were attacked from a foreign enemy. Mm-hmm. Here, this was Americans attacking Americans. I did think the trauma, the tragedy, the horror, the death and mayhem of that moment would have others recognize this has gone too far. And sadly, I thought it would pull us together. I was wrong on that. I think maybe your history professor in the previous block said it right, that this is not a spectator sport. It requires all of us. Justice William Brennan said that the Constitution will endure only if we have the courage to defend it, the vision to interpret it, and the fidelity to live by it. It is on all of us, not just elected officials or election officials. It's on all of us, members of the media, every citizen, to recognize the fragility of our democracy and to stand up and have that courage to defend it and live by it.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Luann. She says, we need televised hearings so the nation feels a sense of urgency about what's happening. It needs to be put in front of the public. My understanding is the January 6th panel is going to have public hearings. I'm not sure when they're scheduled to take place. But do you agree with that, Congresswoman Dean?
Oh, I absolutely do. I look forward to it. I'm a child of the Watergate era. I know that we as citizens needed to learn in a public forum to hear questions asked, to hear answers or failed answers to those questions, to hold people accountable. You're right. So much of what goes on in D.C. sometimes feels like it's just chaotic within a loop or a silo. The American people have a right to know and a responsibility to learn what was challenged on January 6th and the days leading up to it and the days following. I look forward to the public hearings, and I cannot say enough. Having served as an impeachment manager, I know the quality of the people who are on the 1-6 commission, bipartisan commission, with Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, and the incredible staff that is working behind them. We do need public hearings so that we air exactly what happened. The only way to disinfect our democracy from this is to shine a bright light on it. I look forward to those hearings.
Here's an email from Neil. It's fit and proper to rail against a Republican attack on democracy, but I believe that the National Democratic Party has been asleep at the switch for a couple of decades and not representing the working people of the country. He goes on from there. But Madeleine Dean, I've heard that before, that either feeling as if the Democratic Party doesn't represent the aspirations of people who vote Democratic, and that they don't sort of play the same kind of game as the Republicans.
Well, to your point about play the same kind of game, we have been accused of that and are guilty of it. I resist the games, the lies, the disinformation that the Republican Party has sadly, many of them, not all, many of them have devolved into. And there are some members, to your first question, there are some members on the other side of the aisle that I do get along with. Of course, they didn't vote to decertify the election. Some voted to impeach this president. But I would push back on the idea that the Democratic Party doesn't represent democratic values or working people. I think that's exactly who we are. We're very big. We're broad. I hope we are as inclusive as possible. But take a look at what we've done this year with only Democratic votes. We helped working families. We said that we will invest in our infrastructure. We said that we will continue the child tax credit for working families, making a difference in millions of families' lives, pulling 40% of children out of poverty. I believe the Democratic Party is doing the work of the common good, the greater good. I think your writer is probably right that we don't message it as well as we ought to. We try to over-explain. But I believe we are good representatives of a governing party. The other side of the aisle, sadly, has devolved into not even wanting to govern. Wouldn't even the Senate, you saw, for example, stripped out supplemental funding for Capitol Police following the insurrection. The Republican senators stripped that out. When you're at that base level of failing to govern and recognizing the need of those who saved our lives, I think that's a party to look at and to say, how can you heal yourself? That party, we need that party to get healthy.
Let me just add, there's a listener who's really mad at me. Drew, upset that we had no Republicans. I should say we had Al Schmidt, a Republican, on the show yesterday talking about the election. So I appreciate your comments. Drew, but he's mad at me because when you said the Republican Party is a cult, that I didn't push back on that. So let me do it now.
I thank you for pushing back. It's certainly not all of them. I just lifted up Liz Cheney and the distinction with which she is serving in Congress. But this fidelity and fealty to the former president, to a set of lies. You see members of committees that I am on, whether it's Mr. Jordan and others, continuing to spew big lies as they also don't reveal their own participation or not in what took place leading up to January 6th. What took place on January 6th. There is something, I've stopped asking myself, do they believe the lies they are spewing? I actually just try to look at what is motivating them. And what is motivating many of them is clinging to power or searching for greater power. That notion of, oh, I don't want to alienate my base who also believes in these lies because maybe they'll throw me out of office. When we don't prize the truth, when we don't have Republican leaders like Mr. McCarthy staying with that clarity of the responsibility that rests on the former president, then that is when we morph into a cult. Look at some of the interviews of American citizens who came with American flags and Trump flags and beat Capitol Police officers because they believed the big lie. That is cult-like behavior. And in this case, sadly, it's coming from lies from the very highest part of our government.
We have to leave it there. Representative Madeleine Dean, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Be well.
You too. To replay this hour and for more Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.